This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are ready. We are eager to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
We have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also from our office in Britain, visiting there from Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
Let's get right to business. Is Russia gearing up for another invasion? In the last few years, it has, it's made a kind of a habit of doing that, gobbling up territory in Georgia, Crimea, Ukraine, then pulling back and being quiet for a while. Well, it's been rather quiet for a while, but there are signs that Russia may be ready to take another aggressive move forward. And to tell us about these signs, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
So on Wednesday, the FSB, this is the successor to the KGB, they accused, they said that Ukraine had carried out, quote unquote, terrorist attacks in Crimea over the weekend. Then there have been a lot of reports from within Crimea and even from the parts of Ukraine under Russian control or separatist control of Russian weapons. Russian troop movements. There have been some significant Russian naval movements. Armored personnel carriers, etc., have been spotted crossing into Crimea. So there's a lot of talk from Russian officials about the possibility of war, blaming Ukraine for terrorist attacks, beating war drums, and there's a lot of military activity. And I believe July was one of the biggest deaths in the separatist-controlled region in recent years, so military activity is heating up there as well.
So what is Russia up to here, Richard? Why are they doing this?
Well, I think there are three plausible reasons for this. The first is that they actually intend to invade. Personally, I think that I'd rate that as plausible but unlikely. Obviously, they chose not to invade huge chunks of Ukraine last time around a few years ago. Not much since then has changed, so it'd be hard to see why they would want to do that now. I do think they intend to gain control of that somehow at some point in the future. And perhaps this dente with Turkey that has happened in recent days, they may think that that has provided them with a window of opportunity where they could get more involved in Ukraine without Turkey's opposition. So it's possible, but I think unlikely. The second possible reason is this could actually be about Russian internal politics. So just today, Sergei Ivanov was fired. He is one of the at one point, he was basically Vladimir Putin's right-hand man. He is one of the most influential people in Russia, one of the most powerful people in Russia. And the fact that he has been let go shows that there could be something very interesting going on behind the scenes within the Kremlin. Winston Churchill famously said once, "Kremlin political intrigues are comparable to a bulldog fight under a rug. An outsider only hears the growling, and when he sees the bones flying out from beneath, it's obvious who's won." So it's hard to get a good picture of exactly what's going on, but Ivanov has been very closely associated with the FSB, and the FSB has made huge gains in power over the past 6 months or so, and perhaps potentially even been obstructing some things Vladimir Putin has been wanting to do. The FSB has also been competing for influence with the GRU, which is the military intelligence inside Ukraine. So there could be some element of competition here. This could be some kind of push by the FSB to gain more power within Ukraine. It could be the GRU pushing back. So it could have something to do with just that internal political infighting that there seems to be going on within the Kremlin right now. And I think the third, and personally, I think the most likely possibility is that in doing this, Vladimir Putin is preparing for negotiations with the West and with Europe. There are a huge number of different areas where Europe and Russia's interests interact. They want some kind of agreement probably in Syria. Even with the economic crisis that we've talked about before, there's potential for Vladimir Putin to cause problems for Europe in solving the euro crisis. Everything going on in Syria and the Middle East, that affects the migrant crisis. So there's a lot of different areas their interests intersect. And perhaps by acting aggressive right now, Vladimir Putin is trying to push the West to come to the table, to make them kind of desperate to say, OK, let's not have a war, and to kind of get the West now more willing to listen to what Vladimir Putin wants. We have seen rumblings out of Germany, like we've talked about on this program, that a lot of German leaders are receptive to a deal with Russia. And so this could be now part of him to kind of launch a final push to actually get a deal sorted.
It's interesting to think about, say, a deal between Europe and Russia with Ukraine at the heart of it. And this is really something that we've talked quite a bit about. Maybe you can just help to put this in the context of biblical prophecy. We've talked a lot about Ukraine being kind of the dividing line between Europe and Asia, and not quite sure which direction Ukraine would break or if it would actually split in half. How do you see this playing out ultimately?
Well, I think keeping Ukraine out from being a strongly Western-aligned state is an absolutely core interest for Russia, and I think they'd be willing to go to war in pursuit of that interest. Apart from that, they want to make sure that Ukraine is at very least neutral. But as we just talked about, this is probably for Russia one of the most important, but there are a whole range of issues where their interests align. And so this is an area, or this would be a core area, where we would expect Europe and Russia and Germany to sit down and come to an agreement. And this is something we've talked about a lot on the Trumpet. And it's not something we've talked about necessarily because there's a specific prophecy in the Bible that says that this will happen. It is definitely related to prophecy, but it's one that springs very naturally from history. Mm-hmm. Russia and Germany they both have the ability to really threaten each other, so that if either wants to project power on the world scene against a third party, they need some kind of accommodation with the other nation. Now, Bible prophecy does tell us that Germany and that Russia are going to seek to project power against other parties. Therefore, they're going to need to come to some kind of an agreement to do that. And just history shows us when you see these two powers coming to an agreement, you know, watch out, because they're now freed up to make a big difference elsewhere.
Well, thanks for that, Richard. While we are on the subject of Russia, another story out of Russia this week, that it looks to be mending fences with Turkey. Richard, you mentioned that these two nations had a huge falling out after Turkey shot down a Russian plane earlier this year. But this week, Turkey's president, who has really been emboldened since putting down a failed military coup last month, actually took a trip to Moscow. And we're going to find out what's happening here, why it's significant, by turning to Brent Noctegal.
It's actually quite interesting. He didn't go to Moscow. He went to St. Petersburg, still in Russia, but that's more of the ceremonial place where the Tsars used to live. So Putin projecting his position that he believes he fulfills in a way by meeting with the Sultan of Istanbul, if I could call him that, or Ankara, the Turkish president. He met him there. Now, this is the culmination of, as you said, the mending of fences, or the warming of ties that needed to happen for Turkey and Russia to continue their relationship with one another. It's interesting when you're talking about Ukraine before and how Ukraine sits between Europe and Russia, and they have to reach some type of accommodation with one another in that region. But you also have Turkey functioning in a similar way, in that Europe really needs Turkey to be its friend at the moment, as we've talked about before, because they can put down the drawbridge and let all the migrants cross into Europe. They could do that if they wanted to, so we need to see a relationship there. But also, Turkey needs Russia because of the economic benefits that they get from the huge trade that they do between the two countries. So we've talked about previously how Turkey really was pushed into a corner in this situation with Russia and eventually had to apologize for shooting down their jet. Erdogan issued him a letter saying that he apologized for doing that. And this visit to Putin in his home country does really show that they are much closer now and willing to work with one another and get back on somewhat equal terms.
What's driving this, Brent? Another inflection point or another common cause that both of these countries share is what's happening in Syria. How much is that playing a factor in here?
Yeah, and that's the big point here, because these two countries are seen to be on opposite ends of this fight, or opposite corners of this fight in Syria. Turkey supporting the rebels, their Sunni Arab state supporting the rebels, does not like Assad. Assad's been killing Turkmen again in Syria. And then we have Russia that wants Assad, or at least the Syrian regime, to remain in power. And really, they've been fighting a proxy war against each other, and now they're meeting up and pretending that they're friends. So there is... some people are looking at this saying that what does this, well, asking the question, what does this mean for the Syrian crisis, that you have both enemies meeting up with one another? And Erdogan is trying to show by this meeting that they are seeking some type of solution to the Syrian crisis with Russia. He said just before he visited, a solution to the Syrian crisis cannot be found without Russia. And then he said, we can resolve the Syrian crisis only in cooperation with Russia. So this is a big turning point, because Syria was the reason that they had the falling out. And yet here is the leader of Turkey saying that we need to find a solution here, and that can only happen with Russia's help.
Well, is this a move where Erdogan is operating from a position of strength or from a position of weakness?
In a way, I feel like it's a bit of both. Because he has Europe right now that ever since the coup and the human rights abuses, you could say, that he's the post-coup purge of all these academics and all these people that weren't necessarily related to the coup. This has encouraged a lot of animosity from Europe towards Turkey. And people are saying that Europe needs to cut off relations totally with Turkey. They need to show Erdogan that they can't be bossed around by Erdogan. And then what's he doing right now? He's going up to Russia and saying, okay, Europe, if you don't want to have relations with me, fine. I've got the Russians on my side at the moment, or at least giving that impression, showing that I think this is a big sign to Europe, basically, that he's not willing to be pushed around by them.
Mm. So really, you could see this almost like provoking a certain kind of jealousy or a reaction among Europeans. And already they're in a position, and we actually have on the cover story of the Trumpet Weekly this week an article by Richard Palmer about Europe's dealings with Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir. The title of that article, Meet Europe's Favorite Genocidal Warlord, and just how Europe is really in a position where it's having to compromise its principles in order to make pragmatic accommodations with some of these unsavory leaders. Its dealings with Erdogan has definitely fit into that category, where they almost have no choice but to try to accommodate them. So here you're viewing this as Erdogan kind of making a statement to Europe that, look, if you aren't going to deal with me, I'm going to turn elsewhere and maybe trying to get more accommodation from them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The same kind of spirit, the same kind of compromise that you're seeing Europe make with its dealings with African states, trying to pay them off to try and keep their states as prisons and basically not let their people out. It's what you see with Turkey. The Europeans are paying Turkey to act like a prison to keep Syrian refugees in there so they don't come to Europe. And they're being... This is the age of pragmatic leaders that have to look at their own countries and protect their own people, and they're going to have to deal with people like Turkey or Sudan to ensure that their people are safe. So, yeah, I do think that is it. I don't think that this is going to be a sign that Turkey is going to be in bed with Russia and at the expense of Europe in any way. Bible prophecy shows us that isn't going to be the case. I think this is just going to... let Europe know that you're going to have to deal with us one way or another, and however we act, so be it.
Yeah, and short term at least, it does look like this could be quite prophetic. And like you'd mentioned, Psalms 83, that we're looking for both Turkey and Syria to be in an alliance with Europe. And then as Richard mentioned earlier, there's some prophetic implications and definitely historical implications of at least a short-term deal between Russia and Europe, which means that for at least a short period of time, however superficial the alliance may be, you'll see an alignment of Europe, Russia, Turkey, and Syria more or less on the same page.
A whole lot of pieces at play here. Right. I mean, it's like we're watching this chessboard and with some idea of the ultimate outcome, watching the way that all of these relationships are developing in the short term is really fascinating to keep our eyes on. We appreciate that, Brent. You are listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to stick with news out of Asia, but we're going to look at the other major power inhabiting the region, China. We've talked on this program about China's resurrection of its Silk Road project. We actually have a feature article on that subject in the works for our October print edition, which is currently in production. To give us an update on what China is up to and some new analysis showing just how significant this developing trade route really is, we're going to turn to our Asia Observer, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes. Yeah. As you said, we have talked about the what's called the One Belt, One Road initiative, or it's sometimes nicknamed the New Silk Road or the Silk Superhighway. And it's basically just a network of highways and railways and ports that will stretch from China all the way to Europe. And as you said, it will essentially resurrect and expand the ancient trading route that connected those same regions starting all the way back about 100 years before Christ. And you know, all the way at that time, it provided vital infrastructure, especially to Asian economies, just for centuries and centuries starting then. And now China's determined to revive that route with kind of a 2.0 version. And the purpose is China wants its trade with Europe to be streamlined and expanded and just dramatically increased. So this Silk Superhighway will connect about 60 countries. 4.4 billion people are represented by that, and it's about 40% of the total global economy. So it's a vast region.
Very ambitious project.
Incredibly ambitious. And another goal of it is to boost China's soft power status, because it will spread economic prosperity to some of those Central Asian nations that are pretty isolated and disconnected from much of the world. This project will help to really boost their prosperity. And so,
and I would imagine draw them into China's orbit that much more.
I think that's exactly right. Into both Russia and China's orbit. It'll just align them ever more with those nations. And then another goal of it is to help to internationalize the yuan, China's currency. And that's particularly evident in the fact that a long string of bank branches will be opened up right along that route. So those are the scope and the goals of the One Belt, One Road project. And this week, a new analysis was published saying that by the time it's completed, the project will represent investment worth about $1.4 trillion. Yeah, this was it was an estimate published by Stephen Jin. He's the CEO of Urizen SLJ. And it made quite a few headlines because the mind-boggling figure there just really underscores the scope of the project and the economic impact it'll have. Jin said that this route could leave an economic legacy bigger than the Marshall Plan. That really caught my eye there. Just, you know, the Marshall Plan, of course, was America's effort to rebuild Western Europe after World War II, and just a huge amount of investment that was pumped into that. So the Silk Superhighway is still 30 years or so from completion, but this time frame really underscores China's long-term thinking, which I think Andrew has spoken about on the Trumpet Hour before. The Chinese leadership are not looking just to the end of the year or the end of the election cycle the way American leaders seem to. They have a really long-term view and a long-term plan to become the global superpower. And this Silk Superhighway could end up being just a really vital step toward accomplishing that goal.
Yeah, Richard. Richard is actually the one who wrote this article that we're preparing for this upcoming edition about this very subject. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Jeremiah said. And one thing that just really stood out to me in putting that article together is I watched a lecture by I think it was a Chinese professor who was living in Hungary or Romania or Bulgaria at the time. And he talked about how you had the Battle of Trafalgar, and that gave Britain control of the world's major sea routes. And then America later took control of all the world's major trade routes. And what did you have? You have 200 years dominated by Britain and America.
Right.
And he made the point, look, I'm from China, and I've lived in France. You guys are from Bulgaria, but we're speaking in English. Mm-hmm. American culture is all around the world. Everyone knows about blue jeans, Big Mac, etc. And so he was saying, well, all of that ultimately stems from Britain and America's control of the trade routes. And what China is trying to do here, by boosting Central Asian economies and by creating all of these links, is to ensure that the vast majority of the world's economic activity takes place around trade routes that China controls now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're hoping for a long-term impact. And again, this isn't a short-term payoff, but over the next 100 years, this would be a new Battle of Trafalgar moment, and that the next 100 years would be China's century. That's a lot of the thinking behind this.
Yeah, I know the Chinese generals, actually, if you've read any of the translations of what they've written in Mandarin, are usually very honest about the fact that it's just a fact of geopolitics, that economic power leads to political power, which leads to military power, which eventually leads to cultural power. And as Richard pointed out, it's the same thing with America and Britain. They started with economic trade routes, which led to political influence, which led to military victories in World War I and World War II, and now a culture where the majority of the world's business transactions take place in English.
But well, it is interesting to look at this. It's not hard to see how that kind of economic investment, and you look at something like that as being kind of fundamentally unthreatening, that who wouldn't want some of these areas of inner Asia to be more prosperous and so on. It does have consequences. But I think just looking at it from a prophetic standpoint, not only could you see how greater economic activity on that front and, say, greater prominence of the yuan and Chinese economic dominance would come at the expense of American economic influence. But this whole idea of how much that would unite the continent culturally, economically, and beyond really plays into the prophecy of this Asian superpower that brings together the kings of the East that we talk so much about. And you just wonder how much these economic incentives are going to contribute to the fulfillment of that unification.
Oh, it's already helping heal some of the biggest division on the continent, India and Pakistan. And there are some occasions where the two of them are even coming together so that some of this infrastructure flows through both of their territories. So it's happening already.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. We'll keep us apprised of that, Jeremiah, as it develops. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll have one more story before our first break. Last week, I drove to Wyoming and passed through the beautiful state of Colorado. And along that route, I saw about 15 examples of a new phenomenon, the marijuana dispensary. Never saw one of those before. At least it's new in the United States. I saw one years ago in Amsterdam. But the recent legalization of marijuana is already having some unforeseen consequences. And to teach us more about this, we will turn to Andrew.
Yeah, well, this is going to be a big change in the drug scene in America. Now, the federal government, I guess, just this week came out and decided that they weren't going to legalize marijuana nationwide. But like I said, on the state level, this has been happening to the point where I think 24 of the states have already legalized it for medical use. And four of the states, Alaska, Colorado, Washington, and one other,
Oregon,
right now escapes me, have already legalized it for casual recreational usage. And so we're starting to see now whether some of this, there was a prediction that for the people who are really advocating marijuana usage, one of the big selling points, well, why would you want to legalize marijuana? But one of the big selling points, they said, well, if we can provide American consumers with a legal outlet to buy legally, domestically raised marijuana, they'll be less likely to buy from a criminal syndicate or drug cartel in Mexico. And it will weaken the cartels as these drug operatives from Mexico realize that they're not making the profits they used to, and they give up on their life of crime and go get a job as a locksmith or a florist or an accountant or something like that.
Not likely.
So what that's definitely what they've seen is that with now half the states allowing it for medical use and four of the states allowing it for recreational use, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico, their marijuana profits have gone down about 40%.
Wow.
Now that you can buy legal stuff in America, you don't have to buy from this cartel in Mexico. So, that, I mean, that's millions and millions of dollars of revenue, which hasn't necessarily been lost. It's just been shifted. Is that the operatives, Shorty Guzman and his operatives in the Sinaloa cartel, they just looked at their books, looked at their declining revenues, and decided to do an interdepartment reshuffle and to really start pushing heroin. And so now we've there, and there is a.
These are enterprising businessmen.
Yeah, I mean, Shorty, he's on the Forbes 50 list. He's one of the 50 wealthy men in the world. But it's he sells things all the way from Italy to Sydney, Australia. Hmm. So he's from his base in Mexico. So, I mean, this is definitely, even though it's illegal, it's a multinational enterprise he's running.
So they're shifting their efforts into the heroin market. What sort of effects is this having?
Well, we definitely, I mean, the heroin epidemic's been on rolling for a long time. It only has been escalating. We're getting to a point where there's about 200 deaths by drug overdose a week. Hmm. In America, by heroin overdose a week in America, that'd be roughly 4,000 a year. So, I mean, it's definitely a problem. But they're saying that since he's done this reshift, his heroin profit margins have gone up 70%.
Legalize heroin, then.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I guess that would be the. I wouldn't be surprised if that starts coming into the discussion later on. But I don't know if it's been a net loss or a net gain for the Sinaloa cartel, because obviously heroin's one of those drugs that you make a much higher profit margin on, but the volumes are lower. But I just know that the heroin department of this global enterprise, their sales are up 70%, even as marijuana's down 40%.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting in this excerpt that we have in this week's Trumpet Weekly, this is our weekly news report where we collate all of the important news from the week, was just the quality of the heroin, or the purity level of the heroin, and really the danger associated with this drug. Maybe you can just tell us about that.
Yeah, well, they've definitely ramped it up. I think if I just check my notes here, but they'd been selling about a 40% pure product, and then now some of this new product they're pushing, they've ramped up to 90% purity. Makes it much more addictive, and that's probably one of the ways that they've gotten those margins, their sales up, is that if they're losing on the marijuana sales, we'll just ramp up the purity of the heroin sales, get more people addicted on it, they'll buy that instead.
But the effect is that this is actually increasing the fatality rate among heroin users.
Right, yeah, the amount of overdose, and I don't have the statistics for what the overdose rate was 5 years ago, but like I said, I know it's about 200 deaths a week now. Mm. Because it is a much more potent drug, which just really gets into this. I mean, you can talk about, well, legalize marijuana and you'll cut their profit margins there, and then they just move all their efforts into heroin. So, I mean, I guess if you wanted to take it to extreme reasoning, you could just say legalize heroin and cut their profits there. But you're still not, and that's the one thing is, even if you could cut the criminal activity, which is a big if, a lot of them, they just really shift in, you're not actually decreasing drug usage in America. You're just giving them a legal option.
Right.
And so this problem, it'll never go away completely until people stop buying drugs.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to look at this in the light of a theme that we see a lot of times in these kinds of stories where there is a problem. people approach that problem looking for or trying to create a solution based on their own best assessment of the situation, and yet their solution ends up having unforeseen ripple effects that end up being more problematic than the problem that they purport to solve. You see that in all kinds of areas in human endeavor. If we're looking to our own reasoning to guide us rather than looking to the absolute truth, looking right. to the law of God, looking to God to guide us, then there are always going to be major problems associated with that. Well, we thank you for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about the current state of Europe's migrant crisis, President Obama receiving a letter from an unusual pen pal, how Southern Africa is drying up, and how a significant number of Americans don't have a dollar to their name. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This week's cover story in the Trumpet Weekly, as I mentioned in the last segment, is Richard Palmer's article, Meet Europe's Favorite Genocidal Warlord. It's talking about Europe's dealings with Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir. Why is it dealing with such a blatantly unsavory character? Well, it's to deal with this epic crisis of immigration besieging Europe's borders. It gives you an idea of just how severe the problem is. I would encourage all of our listeners to check out that article on thetrumpet.com or subscribe to the Trumpet Weekly and get this week's edition. But to give us more information on the current state of this migrant crisis, we're going to go back to Britain and to hear from Richard.
Well, if you're anything like me, you'd have assumed that Europe's migrant crisis was really bad last year, that Europe is still struggling to deal with all of those migrants, but that it's dropped off a little so far for 2016. And that's kind of how I'd assumed things are. However, new statistics published this week shows that it's not the case, and that actually more people have arrived in Europe thus far in 2016 than had arrived in Europe at this by the same point in 2015. Over 250,000 people arrived in Europe by the end of July, compared to around 220,000 by the same period in 2015. Now, a lot of this is to do with a surge of immigration that came towards right at the beginning of the year, but it still shows that the numbers are very high. Now, a lot of that migration is also shifting now, so it's coming from Libya and into Italy instead of through Turkey. And so because of that, deaths among migrants trying to get to Europe have also increased. And that's gone up by 15%. And one other just fascinating statistic that I saw this week, for every 100 migrants coming to Europe, 73 of them are men and only 27 are women. So you're seeing Europe continually now still getting flooded, mostly with the largest subgroup being young single men, and that's already made a huge difference, and it's going to continue to make a huge difference.
Essentially, we're looking at the inevitability of this crisis ramping up and the pressure on European politicians to deal with this going to increase. There's actually another story in the Trumpet Weekly this week that talks about just how unpopular European leaders are becoming, how much more discontented with them the Europeans are becoming in general. And this in the light of these terrorist attacks that we've seen in Paris and Brussels, in Germany recently, that where so many of them are being linked to this influx of migrants. So we're really seeing just those problems that have resulted from this this policy to this point are just a fraction of what we can expect to see.
Right. It's definitely a cumulative project. I think even if you had vastly fewer migrants, say, arrive this year than last year, you would still expect more problems because they're adding to the number of migrants that are already there. And a lot of Europe is just at capacity. So, for example, Italy, 2013, they had about 20,000 asylum seekers in shelters. Now they have 140,000 asylum seekers in shelters. And so you start to get all of these shelters just filling up. And then what do? You start to, maybe the government has to come in and build a tent city in your back garden to accommodate all of these migrants. They start to have to get more forceful in forcing local authorities to put migrants in places that they don't want them. And that will dramatically and very quickly increase the antagonism with the locals and the, you know, the native population. And that's just the direct effect of migration. And then, of course, you've got proven evidence already that the Islamic State is trying to smuggle terrorists across with these migrants. That is, of course, going to continue and probably perhaps even increase now that they may be suffering a bit of a setback at home. They may decide that we need to send more people over to Europe. They've seen how effective just very few people can be within Europe.
Right.
So that's going to continue. So you're right. This, even if we saw a much lower figure for 2016 than 2015, the crisis is still going to get much worse. And at the moment, there's no evidence that it is going to be a lower figure.
The cover story of the latest edition of The Trumpet that we finished, the September edition, talks about terrorism's increasing body count. And it just seems like the Islamic State and these Islamist organizations and those who are sympathetic to them, of whom we see an increasing number within Europe's borders, they just seem intent on continuing to push and push as long as Europe permits that. And it seems like there's nothing really to suggest, other than a lot of rhetoric on the part of some European leaders and increasing hostility among the populace, that Europe is really has the will at this point to put a stop to it. So you can absolutely expect them to continue, these terrorists to continue to take advantage of the situation. We appreciate that. Richard, you are listening to Trumpet Hour. One of the most significant developments of 2016 has been the legitimization of Iran on the world stage, thanks to the nuclear deal implemented on January 16th of this year. And recently, we saw America give Iran $400 million more dollars, supposedly to address earlier grievances, but oddly timed perfectly with the release of four American hostages. In a lot of ways, you could say America is uniquely responsible for empowering the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. But voices out of Iran say, not good enough. And to tell us about the most recent complaints from Iran about how the U.S. needs to do even more to help Iran out, here is Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this latest move by Iran to ask for some more money actually came from the former president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, an interesting character that we're watching closely as he rises on the political scene in Iran once again. Well, he wrote a letter to President Barack Obama earlier this week telling him to quickly fix a Supreme Court ruling that allowed terror victims of Iran to collect $2 billion of frozen Iranian assets. So back in April, there was a Supreme Court ruling, 6-2, that 1,300 American victims of Iranian terror and their families would be able to collect $2 billion that are frozen right now in the United States because Iran purchased American bonds, $2 billion worth, a few years ago. So the Supreme Court says, yes, you are going to be able to have access to those funds, basically because your families were affected by terrorist activities of Iran, even going back all the way to the Beirut bombing of the barracks there back in the late 80s. And this former prime minister, or president, sorry, is writing to the president in America saying, you need to fix this right now or this is going to be a stain on your record.
This is a pretty bold move by this fella.
It is very bold when you consider the way the American system works. And generally, a Supreme Court ruling like this, I don't believe, can be overruled so quickly by the president. But former president of Iran thinks it's possible. But I think it goes further than this. It's a very interesting situation we have here, because it shows us what's going on inside Iran as well. The big question is, why did Ahmadinejad write this letter? He's not even in power anymore. I'd just like to quote from an article that kind of discusses the reasoning about this, and it has some significance for why we're watching this fella. This is what it says. It's from El Monitor earlier this week. The timing and focus of Ahmadinejad's letter is perhaps revealing of the former president's future intention. intentions. While Ahmadinejad has been relatively quiet as a former president, he has been speaking at events and rallies across the country in recent months. Whether in Tehran or other provinces, Ahmadinejad still draws a large enough crowd to pack venues. It is no surprise, then, that some view the timing of the letter to be linked to the speculation that Ahmadinejad intends to run for president again, hoping to deny President Hassan Rouhani a second term. So he's writing this letter because essentially he was the one to blame for the fact that America has this Iranian money. He bought American bonds back in 2008 or 2009 when he was still president, and he had people in Iran saying, you better not do this. But after he bought the bonds, sanctions came on and that money became frozen in the United States. So he is trying to rectify this situation so that he can come to the polls next year with a clean slate and getting their money back from the Americans.
I think it was just a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, where you brought a story to our attention about Ahmadinejad and his possible designs on running for president in the future, and considering how much emphasis the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has put on that man personally, it will be interesting to watch to see whether or not he actually does step back into the spotlight and play a major role in Iranian affairs going forward. But this is another piece of evidence of intrigue and interest in that story. Thanks for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to look at some environmental news next. A major drought is taking place in the southern part of Africa. And to learn about this, we're going to look to Jeremiah.
Yeah, since late 2015, southern and eastern Africa have been suffering the worst drought to hit the region in decades. Some sources say since 1982, some say since 1992. But it's from Zambia to South Africa, and there's just been significant crop failure. Livestock have been starving, and food prices are soaring. Right now, there are already some 23 million people in need of food support, and experts say that by the end of the year, that number will exceed 50 million. So it's a huge amount of people being affected by this drought. And of course, the hardest hit so far have been farmers. In South Africa, which is the continent's breadbasket, anywhere from 30 to 40% of all the corn crops are projected to fail this year. And South African authorities have declared drought emergency in 8 of the country's 9 provinces. And about 15,000 of the country's 35,000 commercial farmers are already in really dire straits financially and in need of government assistance. So it's playing out similarly in Zimbabwe and Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, Mozambique, Namibia, Swaziland, and Zambia. So it's really far-reaching. And of course, farmers are not the only ones hit by this. The chief of communication at UNICEF Zimbabwe said school enrollments are significantly down because of the drought. And that's because many families have been forced to put their children into the workplace to make ends meet. And he said girls are the hardest hit by this because families often try to push them into early marriages in order to have one less mouth to feed in their household. So there are just all kinds of long-term impacts that this drought could have on the region. And authorities blame it on an abnormally strong El Nino, which struck the region toward the end of last year and which really severely delayed the rains there. And that strong El Nino, they say, is the result of man-made climate change, a lot of them. But readers of the Philadelphia Trumpet will know that we keep a close eye on weather and on disasters such as droughts, because the Bible says that weather is a major tool that God often uses to communicate to people. And if any of our listeners have not done so, I would just encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com and read our free booklet, Why Natural Disasters. It does an excellent job of explaining how weather is used to stir people up sometimes and to shake nations. And we send this booklet out at no charge. So if you just visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab, you'll see it in the list there, Why Natural Disasters. And I think that as we continue to see more and more droughts and other weather upsets, this book will just become more and more relevant.
Yeah, well, while we're in advertising mode, I might just say that listeners can go to thetrumpet.com or to the Trumpet Weekly for this week and look at Jeremiah's article on this subject. The title of it is Southern and Eastern Africa Suffers Worst Drought in Decades. That gives a little more of the context of what you're talking about there, why this really is important from a prophetic standpoint. So definitely something to look at. We appreciate that. Jeremiah, this is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio. We're going to conclude this segment with an economic story. Just how indebted are Americans? Well, an amazing number of us have a negative net worth. We owe more than we own. So we're going to hear more about this from Andrew.
Right. You always hear a lot about this massive $20 trillion debt the federal government has. But then also in addition to that, there's also another $12 trillion debt that's held collectively by American consumers. That's all the mortgages and credit card debt and student loans and all that, which, according to at least to an article from Bloomberg this week, is actually 1 in 7 or 14% of Americans, like you said, actually have a negative net worth. If you tally up all their cash, all their property, all their assets, and then subtract all your debts, mortgages, and that, you come out in the red. And it kind of brings up an interesting point here in this article that there's two ways someone could become poor. The first, and probably a little more self-evident way, is just not make a lot of money. But the second way is actually to make a lot of money and then just spend even more money. Because that they're bringing in, it's all kind of coincidental right now, but they say it's about 14-15% of Americans, they say, are below the poverty line, meaning that for a family of four, you'd have to make less than $23,000. It's also 14% of Americans who have a negative net worth, but there's probably a little bit of overlap, but they're not necessarily the same group. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of these, or at least a number of these people with a negative net worth, I mean, they may have a decent salary and a large home and a couple of cars and a color TV, but if you're underwater on your auto loan and your house isn't worth what your mortgage is anymore and you've racked up a bunch of student debt and credit card debt, you can still make a six-digit salary and have a negative net worth.
Well, it's essentially the same economic model that the federal government is employing, taking in quite a bit in tax income, but spending considerably more than that, going deeper and deeper into debt. Americans are just following the example of their government.
Right, or possibly even the other way around, as much as they complain about the irresponsible politicians and how much money they've wasted and how much money they've spent more than they have. As I said, maybe that's due to that the people who elected those guys have the exact same problem in their personal life. But
yeah, this is actually it is a huge problem, and it's another example of where if people consult the wisdom of the Bible, it really can prevent them falling victim to these kinds of economic problems. We actually have a booklet you can find on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab called Solve Your Money Troubles. If you happen to be one of those who are in that 14% or maybe close to it, I would highly encourage you to go check that out. Just really sound, scripturally based advice in that booklet that can help you out. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com, and that's where you can receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. What we talk about on this program week to week as we review the prior week, all of the stories are in The Trumpet Weekly. And you can get a whole lot more on top of what we describe here. We really are scratching the surface on a lot of these stories, and we're missing a lot more. So you can get a whole lot out of that weekly report, and it is absolutely free. You can receive it in your email inbox every Friday. We're going to finish the program next with our lightning round of important news. All of our panelists will get a shot, one more shot at telling us about what's happening in the world. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention. We'll start with Andrew.
Yeah, they had a massive wildfire in the San Bernardino Mountains in California this week. Had hundreds of firefighters and up to 16 aircrafts battling the flames with 175 homes ordered to evacuate and more than 5,000 homes highly recommended to evacuate.
All right, we'll go next to Richard.
Well, while we're on the subject of fires, Portugal was also hit by major wildfires. There are estimated to be around 200 wildfires. Four people were killed by them. It involved around 4,500 firefighters, and they've requested help from other EU nations in dealing with this.
All right, over to Jeremiah.
Satellite imagery published yesterday shows that China has been constructing military aircraft hangars on artificial islands in the South China Sea. This imagery emerged just weeks after the International Court in The Hague ruled against China's territorial claims in these disputed areas. And so it just shows that despite that ruling, Beijing is forging ahead with its militarization of those islands.
Let's go back to Andrew.
Three gangs in Chicago met last Thursday to plot attacks against police officers in response to the shooting of James O'Neill. James O'Neill was a black 18-year-old who rammed a stolen car head-on into a police vehicle and was shot in response. And so now these Chicago gangs are trying to organize and come up with how they're able to strike back at law enforcement.
Let's go now to Brent.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly said that he considers Jerusalem its eternal and undivided capital, and that he will not entertain proposals to concede the eastern half of the city to the Palestinian Authority. And yet, this week, Palestinians are disregarding this. They announced that they are going to set up their own separate municipal council in East Jerusalem. One of their leaders said, as Jerusalem is the capital of the state of Palestine, it is necessary for the Palestinian leadership to strengthen its own residents.
All right, Richard.
Germany is beginning to respond to the Islamic attacks on its soil. Police searched five locations related to three suspected supporters of Islamic State this week. More significantly, the Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière, announced new proposals, such as getting more police on the streets and making it easier to lock up illegal migrants. Some top politicians want to go further, with a lot of support, especially in the Christian Democratic Union, for banning the burqa, the full face veil. And then finally, there was another terrorist attack this week, this time in Brussels, where a man with a machete slashed the faces of two police women.
You guys are cruising along here. We're going to go back to Jeremiah.
Will the Emperor of Japan abdicate? This week, Emperor Akihito strongly hinted that he would like to step down because of his age. He's been the emperor since 1989, and he's now 82 years old, but he says that his age precludes his fulfilling his emperor duties really well, so he's hoping to be able to let his son take over the reins. Allowing him to abdicate would require yet another revision of the Japanese constitution, so this could end up being another hit on that document that has so long helped to preserve peace in the region.
All right, back to Andrew.
Yeah, Canadian police conducted a raid in southern Ontario on Wednesday, arresting Aaron Driver, who they believed was plotting a suicide bomb plot. Driver had been previously associated with the Islamic State and had been under surveillance for a number of years.
All right, back to Brent.
Saudi Arabia has publicly confirmed that it's working with German investigators to track Islamist militants behind bomb and axe attacks. In July, a Saudi spokesman said that the Germans and Saudi Arabian security experts had met and exchanged information regarding the attacks. Reuters reported about this, that Saudi Arabia's comments were very unusual because the kingdom rarely speaks publicly on specific cases of counterterrorism cooperation with foreign countries, and yet they are cooperating with Germany, something Bible prophecy says will continue.
All right, back to Jeremiah.
Russian authorities announced on Thursday that they will significantly expand a base in Syria into a full-fledged military hub. The plan is to assign extra space for large transport aircraft and also to build barracks and hospitals and extra airfield aprons. And this plan also calls for artificial hills to be constructed there, which are to protect the warplanes in the event of shelling. So analysts say that this announcement just shows that Russia's commitment to its military campaign in Syria remains a really high priority.
I thought it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about how Russia was kind of getting in and out, and they left. Now here they're expanding their presence there. Very interesting. And we'll conclude with one final item from Richard.
Scientists believe the Greenland shark lives for a stunning 400 years. That would make it the longest-lived vertebrate, beating the previous record holder, the bowhead whale, that lived for just over 200 years. The margin for error on this is pretty huge. It's 400 years plus or minus 120 years. But even if it's on the minus side and it only lives for around 280 years, that's still a pretty staggering amount of time. And it's always just amazing to me to see, you know, how little we know about the ocean, this thing that covers two-thirds of our planet, and just how many amazingly designed creatures we just seem to be discovering or finding out more about in there all the time.
Yeah, it also just makes me think about if it is 400 years old when, say, that latest shark was born, what was happening in the world, just how quickly events in this world move along. 400 years is quite a long time in geopolitical terms. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up at thetrumpet.com. We're going to be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report that really forms the foundation of our discussion on this program. Tell us what you think of this program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thanks to our technical staff as well, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with the words of Thomas Spratt. What you dislike in another, take care to correct in yourself. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.